How do you like the sound of a bank that's built for you, not the 1%? Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Well, you should check out Chime. Chime isn't just another banking app. They unlock smarter banking for everyday people with products like MyPay, giving you access to up to $500 of your paycheck anytime and getting paid up 2 days early with direct deposit. They also don't charge an overdraft or minimum balance fee, so you're in control of how you spend your money. In fact, there's no monthly fee at all. Instead of charging you to use your own money, Chime actually turns everyday spending into real rewards and progress. It's the new way to build credit history with your own money and get rewarded every single day. Plus, you can earn up to 3% APY on savings, which is 7 times higher than a traditional bank. Several of my mates have already switched to Chime for their everyday spending, and they say that they have never felt more in control of their money. Chime is not just smarter banking, it's the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. It just takes a few minutes to sign up. Head to chime.com/redhanded. That's chime.com/redhanded.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step 3, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti.
And welcome to Red Handed Premium. What a tangled Welsh web we have to weave for you this week. One of the research materials we used was a book, which I found quite difficult to get through. So just make sure you've got your best paying attention hats, I think, is the best thing to do for this one.
Precisely. It is a tangled web we weave in Welsh. Shall I bring out the Welsh accent? I was practicing over my morning coffee this morning.
Were you really?
I mean, not extensively. Basically, I was watching this show. I think I've spoken about it before. I really enjoy this guy called Eric Singer, who does like oration and like accent coaching on YouTube. It's really interesting. Go check it out if you fancy. He does it as like part of a Wired series. And in that, he made this interesting point that if you speak in a Welsh accent and slow it right down, it starts to sound like an Indian accent. And I was practicing that, and it really does. It really does.
That's so bizarre.
Right, I'll try. And if this fails, we will just cut it, and you won't be listening to any of this. It's difficult because I can't, like, speak in a Welsh accent for a very long time, but you need to say quite a long sentence for it to work, so let's give it a try. So, we're off to Wales. We're going to go down to the valleys and have a look at all the sheep. Not bad. So, slow it down. We're off to Wales. We're going to go down to the valleys and take a look at all. No, that didn't work. Wait, it was working before when I did it. Maybe I should do an Indian accent. We're off to Wales. We're going to... I can't do it. I'm stuck in a Welsh accent now.
You're not Indian anymore. You're Welsh.
Oh, no. Fuck.
It's never going to come back.
Go down and take a look at all the sheep. What the fuck is an Indian accent? It's gone. Oh, fuck, it's gone. It's totally gone. Somebody else try if you're listening.
Oh, my God. You've just lost the ability to do an Indian accent. That is so funny.
No, I can bring it back. Right, we're gonna go down. Oh, fuck, it's fucking gone. It's like I've tuned into this and I can't tune back out.
It's like the wind changes and now you're stuck like that.
Oh, shit. Right, one last try and then we're moving on from this catastrophe. Going to go down to Wales and take a look at... Can you see how it's kind of like an Indian slash Welsh?
Yeah, I can see the point.
We're going to go down and take a look at all the Wales, the sheep in Wales. But if you kind of slow it down and stop doing the Welsh accent I'm doing, it sounds like an Indian accent. We're going to go down and take a look at all of the sheep in Wales because, yes, I'm from... No, it's gone. Never mind. Let's move on. Let's get back to the case at hand.
Okie dokie. So let's leave that where it is.
I really tried.
I know you did. I'm very proud of you.
So if we, you, me, them, everybody collectively were all Scooby-Doo when we were looking at this case, we would have started to look for clues in Swansea Town Centre, where there is an array of graffiti murals depicting the words Free Di Morris. Arguably, Scooby-Doo might have been the best man dog for this job, because a lot of people think that the police balls this one right up. Intentionally or not is a matter of your own opinion. So David Morris, also known as Di Morris, most certainly thinks that the police stitched him up. And the Di Morris we are talking about today is absolutely not the same as the international Welsh rugby star known as The Shadow.
I have to apologise to you, Hannah, because I'm the one that told you that it was. And that is my fault fully. I was reading the notes and I was like, whoops, that's what I told her.
But also, like, if you Google Di Morris, that is the first thing that comes up.
I know. And I was like, oh my God, this is such a high profile case. No wonder people are graffitiing it all over the place, like Free Di Morris, because he was some sort of fucking rugby star who was accused of all these murders. But no, it's completely unrelated. The only excuse I have is that we basically, at Red Handed, we're not operating like I suspect other podcasts are, who maybe have like a backlog of shows that they have pre-recorded and they have like a bit of breathing room and they're releasing. We're recording this on Monday morning and it'll be in your ears if you're a patron on Wednesday morning. There is no time. And we were just like, quick, we need a case. What's a good case? And I was like, oh, there's this one of Di Morris, a rugby star who was accused and convicted of murdering a bunch of people. And I led you down completely the wrong rabbit hole.
I literally thought, though, I thought I had cracked this wide open. I was like, there is no mention of it on this Wikipedia page. This is outrageous. Blah, 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 blah. And I also bought the biography of the rugby star thinking that it was about the murders. And then, like, it just starts with this poem about what an amazing rugby player he was. And then I started to read the first chapter and I was like, hang on a minute. This can't be right.
That's amazing. I love that someone somewhere who was rigorously just like watching all of our data, because obviously they've got us, was just like, what the fuck? She usually buys these books and suddenly she's just buying the biography of a Welsh rugby star that's got nothing to do with anything.
I was just throwing off the algorithm.
That's what you got to do. Can't let them have you.
Yeah. So I thought that this case was going to be a classic celebrity protecting murderers. But because rugby is a big deal in Wales, much more so than in England, I would argue. But this time, although it does happen a lot, this time it is definitely not that. I'm just a bit stupid.
And misled by your partner. Sorry.
But I think I would have been misled anyway, because if you Google Di Morris, it's the first thing that comes up is the rugby player.
It is.
Right. So the Di or David Morris that we are actually dealing with today, we're going to leave the rugby man well alone, doesn't show up in our story until much later on. We've got to start off with a fire. This fire and the events that preceded it have been described as a massacre, an orgy of savagery, and the worst crime that Wales has ever seen, which personally I think is a little bit dramatic. A bit of me was like, is this all you've got, Wales? Like, is this the worst one? Have you never had a serial killer? Like, come on.
But that, isn't that just the title of this whole fucking episode? Orgy of Savagery, colon, Di Rugby Star Morris.
Colon, please click here. I'm obviously quite desensitized and a bad person. So, this orgy of savagery, which was first brought to the attention of the emergency services on the 27th of June 1999 at 4:27 a.m. The call came from the village of Cludach, I think is how you say it. But like, considering how we got absolutely turned inside out for how we were saying that Welsh town where Ian Watkins is from, that I'm not going to say because people get...
Pontypridd.
People said that that's not it.
No, I'm pretty sure it is. Pontypridd. I think it's Pontypridd. That's what I'm going to say.
Okay.
Come at me, Wales.
Well, I'm going to leave you to be eaten alive.
I think you said Pontypridd and that's what they got angry at, maybe.
I think it's a TH sound at the end. I think it's a... I don't know.
Pontypridd. Someone tell us. We are here to learn. Tell us nicely.
So Cludach is in the lower Swansea Valley. It's small, sort of like 7,500 people small. And in 1999, if you sold your family home for £35,000, that was considered pretty good going. My gut feeling is that crime rates are higher in England than they are in Wales, but I actually couldn't find anything to prove that because England and Wales have the same legal systems, unlike Scotland, so they're very often just lumped together. Like, if you look at crime stats, it'll say England and Wales. It doesn't tend to separate them. And we have been pulled up on stuff like this before because sometimes, well, something we actively need to try harder and be better at is talking about the UK as a whole when Scotland has a separate legal system. So if you listen to our earlier episodes and hear us refer to the laws in the UK, it's very likely we meant England and Wales.
So the 999 call came from Cludach? Clutha'c.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, sure.
Came from a man who lived on Kelvin Road. He had heard banging and crashing noises coming from his neighbour's house at number 9. This caller, whose name we haven't included because, to be honest, there are a lot of names this week, and this person, although they have served a rather lovely purpose in getting the story started, is fairly inconsequential to the story. So we're sorry about that, but you are not getting a name mention today. And this mystery caller was very familiar with the lady who lived at number 9. In fact, they'd had a brief affair. Her name was Mandy Power, and she lived in the house with her 2 young daughters and her elderly mother. Now, I do know what Mandy Power's kids are called, but I do wish that one of her daughters was called Max, obviously for Max Power, and also because I find little girls with boys' names just fucking adorable. I think that is the cutest thing. Love it.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
It's great.
What's your favourite one?
I can only think of 3, but they're great. Max, Jack, George. So cute.
That's true. Cody, that's a boy's name, girl's name.
Cute. And Ronnie, that's cute.
That is cute. That is cute.
Anyway, right, we're well off track. So sidebar, we're still not getting back on track. We've got a sidebar first. Everyone in this story is shagging absolutely everyone else. Possibly this is because, much like the town that I grew up in, where everyone was doing this, me not included, that is because there is literally nothing else to do in the town of Clutha'c, as far as we can tell. Whenever we introduce a new character into this story, it is safest to assume that they are doing the nasty with someone else in the story. That is why they are there. Also, hot tip, it is literally never their spouse. So yeah, lots of extramarital sex going on in this particular juicy episode.
They can't get enough of it in the valley. Jesus.
They cannot. So the caller heard the racket from number 9, and then he caught sight of some smoke. So he tried to bang on the door himself after Mandy didn't answer the phone, but he couldn't get in. And he could see at this point that the kitchen was on fire. And that's what made him call 999.
The fire brigade arrived in minutes and entered the burning house. Neighbours told them that the Power family were not in the house that night. They were staying with friends, but tragically, they couldn't have been more wrong. Mandy and her young girls had been out that night, but they'd returned home just after midnight. This was corroborated by the taxi driver who dropped them off. Doris was in the house for the entire evening, alone. So every member of the Power family were in the house that night, and at some stage, they all died. The fire brigade pulled them out of their home as it blazed around them. They lay the bodies of 80-year-old Doris, her daughter, 34-year-old Mandy, and Mandy's own children, Katie, who was 10, and Emily, who was just 8. The bodies of the Power family were laid in front of the house as the flames were extinguished, and 2 things were soon clear. All 4 of them were dead, and it was obviously not the smoke or the fire that had killed them. All 4 people, including the children, had been savagely beaten to death. Paramedics made attempts to revive the family, but they were no use. The injuries to the Power family were so severe that when they were eventually x-rayed at the coroner's office to determine their cause of death, they were x-rayed inside their body bags. Like, that's the state they were in.
Oh my God, that's tough. So 8-year-old Emily had taken 15 blows from a blunt object. Mandy, her mum, had 38 separate injuries, with 15 blows to her face alone. Her skull was broken into 10 separate pieces, and she had marks consistent with strangulation on her neck. It would later also be ascertained by the coroner's office that a vibrator had been inserted into her vagina after she had died, or at the very least, after she had become immobile. I don't want to say that's the worst bit, but that's not a great bit.
I mean, it just makes it obvious that this is a very personal attack.
Oh, yeah.
And that Mandy's the centre of it.
Blows to the face, violent up-close beating like this, and the vibrator, I think suffice to say it's someone she knows and it's personal, like you said. So someone had gained access to the house that night before the fire had started and killed the Powers, like we said, in a very personal, very violent way. Doris, Mandy's 80-year-old mum, was found battered in her bed. The girls had been found in their room and on the landing, but not in their beds. Mandy was the last to be found, and she was in her own bedroom. And it does seem, as Hannah said, that Mandy was the main target of the attack. Whoever had carried out this atrocity had a particular bone to pick with her. And we know this because Mandy's body was discovered totally naked. And like we said, someone had shoved a vibrator inside her. Much further than it should have gone. No paramedic, no fire person is qualified to handle a murder investigation or a crime scene. So, of course, the police were called in.
Acting Sergeant in the area, Constable Alison Crewe, arrived at the scene 5 minutes after she received the call. But this was all a bit above her pay grade, so she called in her senior officer, D.I. Stuart Lewis. He had been on the force for over 20 years, and he even had a few murder convictions under his belt. He showed up, had a look at the bodies, and then he left.
This was not what he should have done according to police protocol. He should have stayed at the house. He should have secured the crime scene, and he should have reported the deaths to his superiors. But he didn't. He just left about 10 minutes after he had arrived. And we know he would have known what to do. He's not a rookie cop. He's worked on murder investigations before, so it's hard to feel like this was an honest mistake. So D.I. Stuart Lewis left the scene and returned to the police station, where he logged the fire at Kelvin Road. He logged that the Power family had died, but he missed out the crucial detail that it was not the fire that killed them.
That is immediately very, very odd, right? Okay, you're leaving the crime scene. It's not strictly police protocol. Maybe if you have been on the force for 20 years, you've got a few murder convictions under your belt already, you're a very senior police officer. I'm not saying that you would just think you could do whatever you wanted, but maybe you would be like, okay, that's just protocol, that's the book, but like, I know what I'm doing, so it's okay for me to leave. The scene's been secured, whatever. But going away and filing this information and missing out a crucial, not even a crucial, the crucial point of this case, I can't find a reason why you would do that other than something we won't get to yet.
Nice.
Nice.
It's just incredibly suspicious, isn't it? There's literally no other way around it. Because, like, the police, of all people, should be the first ones to know that there's a fucking murderer on the loose that's battering children to death.
That's what I mean. And there's no confusion. It's not like, you know, they were poisoned maybe and you don't find out for much later afterwards that, you know, that they actually died from poisoning and it wasn't from the smoke inhalation. Their faces are bashed in. Smoke doesn't do that to a person. A person with a big fucking rod does that to a person. This is very suspicious immediately. And you do have to think, like, the only reason someone would make a mistake like this is, well, you know, we've all learned from the Breonna Taylor case when they went away and wrote down that fucking she was fine after they'd shot her. You're probably not the most innocent person.
No, exactly. So the consequence of this lacking to log was that the rest of the Swansea police force were not aware that there had been a quadruple homicide on their watch until the shift change hours later. So that's, you know, hours that the crime scene hasn't been secured, hours where anyone could have walked into that house, hours, hours, hours. Stuart Lewis, interestingly, was spotted making a long phone call from a payphone in the police station. Why would he do that? I mean, I know it's 1999 and he might not have had a mobile phone, but he's literally at his work. He has an office. He's a detective inspector. Why isn't he using his office phone?
Well, things that are going to ruin the suspense if I start pointing. It's not normal. It's very atypical, I would say.
Exactly. Completely bizarre behaviour from an experienced policeman, especially considering that this murder investigation would turn into the largest in Welsh history, and there would be 50 detectives assigned to the case over a period of 3 years, and £6 million was spent.
And this is the thing. If you are D.I. Stuart Lewis, you've been on the force for all these years, you've seen your fair share of murder investigations, you've been plugged into the Welsh criminal system for decades by this point. How do you not take one look at that murdered family and know immediately this is going to be fucking massive and I should do everything right because look at this. If you're doing everything wrong, which is what he seems to be doing at this early stage, suspect. So, like Hannah said, the crime scene was left open for anyone and everyone to traipse through, which on top of the fire meant that there was very little evidence indeed to be collected from the house. The police tried to blame this on the fire brigade, trampling all over the house, trying to, you know, save the lives of those people and do their fucking literal jobs. Honestly, how fucking dare they? It's just, it's sick. It's sick. Like, we're already starting off on just like a completely sick foot here.
They didn't know they were already dead. What were they supposed to do?
And also, when you arrive at a fire and there is a fire raging and you don't know what the situation is, even if you knew that there were four people inside who had been murdered, that is not the number one task at that point. The number one task is stopping the fire and getting anybody out and possibly saving their lives. Then after that, it becomes a murder investigation. For them to turn around and try and blame the fire brigade is just honestly really, really scraping the barrel in terms of the depths of depravity that we can imagine. I hate it so much. But despite the lack of evidence, it didn't mean that the house had absolutely nothing to offer at all. The murder weapon, was quickly identified to be a heavy 4-foot fiberglass pole that had been taken from the garden shed. It weighed about a kilo and had traces of blood found on it. The blood was also found all over the walls and the floors. Now, I'm not sure how much stock to put in this, but we have read in several different places that it was decided by martial arts experts, wherever you may find them in the Swansea Valley, that whoever was wielding the fiberglass pole must have had some martial arts training. How in the world that can be ascertained, we have no idea, but we thought it was worth mentioning.
It's a nice detail, and we will come back to it later on, but I just don't know how you can possibly know that. If you are a martial arts expert, let us know.
Please explain how you would know.
At number 9 Kelvin Road, there was no sign of forced entry, apart from the unsuccessful battering of the door by the 999 caller with no name. So it's likely that the killer was either let into the house by Mandy herself, indicating that they were known to her, or the killer had a key of their own. A blood-soaked sock was found on the floor of Mandy's bedroom. Forensic investigators deduced that it had been used by the attacker as a glove to prevent the leaving of fingerprints. I know this is a really horrible murder, but we all know how I feel about sock puppets.
We do.
I think they're very funny. That's quite comical. There's this person running around with socks on their hands.
I mean, you're right. It is very funny. And when I read that, that is the visual that immediately jumped into my mind. Also, like, how slippery. You can't even get your thumb, like, properly around this, like, fiberglass pole that weighs a kilo that you've stolen from the garden shed to batter this family to death. But you're doing it in gloves. Also, that kind of indicates to me, and I don't know, I'm just saying at this point, it's something to point out. Somebody gets into the house, they didn't even bring gloves and they're planning on murdering you. Like, is this a spur of the moment thing? Like, them just grab some socks and start doing it? But then it's also quite, like, savvy. It doesn't feel like a snap decision, you know, if you're thinking about fingerprints.
Oh, yeah.
It's interesting.
That's the one thing about this case is, you know, whoever did it knew exactly what they were fucking doing. And they did a pretty good job because they're still out. So this sock theory is also backed up by Luminol revealing 2 handprints in the house that looked like they had been made by hands inside socks and therefore comical but forensically useless.
Hate it.
Okay, right. This bit's difficult. Pay attention because it took me a while to get my head around this. The inspection of the house revealed that the light bulb in Doris's bedroom was smashed during the attack. It was also ascertained that Doris was the first to die by about 30 minutes to an hour. And the light bulb smashing caused a fuse to blow, and that would have plunged the house into darkness, which is not very good for murdering with a pole. You need to be able to see what you're smashing at. So the killer went down to the fuse box, which was downstairs, replaced the fuse. So this is hardly the behaviour of someone on a murderous rampage. Whoever it was had the time and patience to play electrician. So we can assume that they were waiting for Mandy and the girls to come home. And that means the killer knew where Mandy was and when she was likely to return, again indicating that they were an intimate part of her life. And this may seem like an outrageous thing to know. When I was reading about this, like, how can they possibly fucking know that he changed a fuse? The theory is this. So in the girls' bedroom, there was a TV that usually sat on top of a chair. But the night of the fire, the chair had been moved downstairs to the fuse box. The TV remained in the girls' bedroom, and when it was inspected by police, it was covered in blood like the rest of the room, but the chair was not, meaning that it had been moved before the girls were killed. So some people use this as obviously the things we said that, you know, this person is lying in wait for Mandy to come home and gets rid of Doris, blah, blah, blah. I don't think it is impossible that the chair could have been there all day. I just don't think so. But what people are saying is that because the light bulb was like freshly smashed on the floor, and who leaves shards of glass on the floor of their 80-year-old mother's bedroom? So I'm not entirely convinced by it, but I do think it has some pros to it.
It does. I feel like as a theory, when it's packaged up like that and it fits the physical evidence that's found at the scene, that narrative does have a lot of merit to it. I would buy into it, but I'm not saying it's like rock solid. So Doris's bedroom had another gift to give up. On the floor, alongside the remnants of the smashed light bulb, was a gold chain with a broken clasp. This chain would end up being the glue that held the whole case together. Or not, depending on whose side you are on. But wait a bit to decide. So further inspection revealed that several fires had been started at number 9 in the early hours of that morning. it was suspected that the killer torched the house to, of course, like we've talked about before, destroy the evidence. But the first few fires failed to take hold. Perhaps the killer or killers had even left the building only to return when they realized that the house hadn't caught alight. Even though there were several fires in the house, strangely, the bath still had some water in it, but there was absolutely no DNA found in the water, not even belonging to the people who lived there. This indicated then that the killer had showered in the house after the murders and had cleaned the bathroom so well that they had left no trace of themselves. But the problem is that normal bleach won't totally get rid of DNA. Only oxygen-producing bleach like Vanish does that.
And to know that very specific piece of information in 1999 is pretty specialist knowledge. So if you look at that alongside so little other evidence being found at the scene, it makes you think that whoever cleaned up the crime scene knew what they were doing and they must have been knowledgeable of forensics. There was one set of fingerprints found inside the house that did not belong to the Power family or any of their immediate circle. To find out who that person is, you'll have to wait. DNA evidence was discovered on Mandy Power's thigh and on the vibrator itself. The DNA came from the vaginal fluid of a lady called Alison Lewis, and the fact that it was still on Mandy Power after she had been in a fire indicates that the pair had close sexual contact very recently before Mandy was beaten to death with a fiberglass pole. But according to Alison, the last time her and Mandy had sex was over 20 hours before the fires were started. So it seems unlikely that her DNA would have stayed on Mandy for that long, particularly when you consider that Mandy suffered from psoriasis, which she was very self-conscious about. So she showered up to and sometimes even over 4 times a day. Her not showering for 20 hours, especially when she would have been out meeting friends and family, just seems highly unlikely. Most people who knew Mandy knew that her and Alison had been sleeping together for a while. No one saw it as a particularly serious relationship. Mandy had several casual affairs going on at any one time. But Alison Lewis is interesting because she was a police officer and therefore would have been familiar with forensics. Alison joined the force in 86. She was also the 4-time Welsh Ladies Karate Champion, the youngest person to ever represent Britain at a senior level. And Alison Lewis was married to a man, a policeman. No less.
It's all coming together. So Alison's policeman husband was called Sergeant Stephen Lewis. Clearly, in 1999, their marriage was in considerable trouble, given that Alison was having an affair with somebody else.
I think Alison was a bit of a Jack the Lad as well. Apparently, she just sort of goes around all of the rugby clubs and picks up the ladies. And I think that her and Mandy had had a possible falling out, not a very serious one, but about Alison sort of sleeping with other women. But Mandy was also sleeping with loads of other people as well. So I don't know how true that is.
She's having a good time. So her marriage isn't having a good time. So Alison, like Hannah says, is going around the rugby club. She's got Mandy. She's having a good time outside of her marriage. So according to Alison, by 1999, she had had enough of leading a double life. So she had decided that she wanted to leave her husband, Sergeant Stephen Lewis, and she was planning, apparently, according to her, to start a new life with Mandy. Now, whether Mandy was on board with that, we don't know. And we will never know, because obviously she isn't here to tell her side of the story. Alison's interviews to TV crews are all that we have. So Alison's story is as follows. On the night of the murders, she and Stephen were at home in bed together. She woke up twice in the night and he had been there both times, giving them both a reasonably solid alibi. Sergeant Stephen had left for work a little after 5 a.m. Alison received a phone call at 6 a.m. from her friend telling her what had happened, and she took herself off to 9 Kelvin Road. There she was spotted by multiple people, including her own husband, and they all said that she looked visibly distressed. Two other neighbours claim that she was there before 6 a.m. though, smelling strongly of soap. And one more thing, Alison Lewis, given her affair with Mandy, had a key to number 9. She was the one to identify the bodies. After that, she checked herself into a psychiatric ward for 2 weeks, where she was on round-the-clock suicide watch. She refused to give a statement to the police during this period, but she did offer up her spit as a DNA sample, which would, of course, go on to be matched with the DNA on Mandy's thigh.
So even though we've got Alison's DNA and the fingerprints of the person that you're not allowed to know about yet, no arrests happened. Instead, the South Wales police carried out a door-to-door investigation, which is literally just wandering around houses asking people if they've seen anything. And as you can imagine, this turned out some very unuseful information. But one woman had seen something. Nicole Williams had been driving around at about 2:30 a.m. in the Kelvin Road area. She saw a tall man on the side of the road. He had dark, cropped hair, dark jeans and a shiny bomber jacket. Nicole described this jacket as being something she'd only seen the police wear. Which, I don't know, man. Like, it's a bomber jacket. It's 1999. Everyone's got a black bomber jacket. Like, I don't know why she says that, but she consistently says it in, like, every interview she does. I don't know. This bomber jacket man was carrying a kit bag under his arm, and he was only yards from Kelvin Road. And 2:30 was before the final fire was set. The man looked straight at Nicole through her windscreen, so she got a really good look at his face. She and the police created an e-fit, and it was absolutely the spitting image of Sergeant Stephen Lewis. This e-fit was never released to the public, and Sergeant Lewis was not called in for questioning. Nothing really happened, even though Nicole pulled Stephen out of an identity parade. Stephen Lewis maintained that he knew nothing of his wife's affair with the deceased Mandy Power and therefore had no motive to want Mandy dead. I know. It's like, it's almost too neat, isn't it? Like, it's almost too obvious.
Oh my God, this is the thing. I don't know what to think. This is the kind of time I wish that people could see our faces, because I'm just like kind of confused, kind of like exasperated by this whole situation, because I'm like, this woman who is like so adamant that it's a police officer she says she sees his face, she draws the e-fit of him, pulls him out of an identity parade, kind of feels too perfect, but then also the police do nothing with that information, which also feels like such a fucking stitch up. I don't know, it's a lot. So obviously, like we said, Stephen Lewis is going around saying he didn't know anything about Mandy and Alison's affair, but according to other people in Cluedhac, that was not the case. A neighbour, Louise Pugh, claimed to have seen Stephen standing on the steps of Mandy's house screaming, "Come anywhere near my fucking wife again and I'll fucking kill you."
So it seems like he probably did know about it.
Seems like he had his suspicions. Feel like he, you know, suspected something was going on. And of course, this is just one person. And this person, Louise, could obviously be making it up. But the general feeling in town was that Stephen knew about the affair. But general feelings in gossipy communities are no good to anyone in the court of law. The thing is, Stephen Lewis is not the only person that e-fit looked like.
I fucking love this bit.
Because it also looked quite a lot like his identical twin brother, Stuart Lewis. As in D.I. Stuart Lewis, who was called in to the scene and then left without doing his job. The police officer with 20 years experience and some homicide convictions that went back to the police station and said that they had died in the fire and not from being smashed in the face.
Isn't that just the best little, like, wrap it up in a bow?
God.
Honestly.
It's just like, ah, I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's something. Someone tell us what that is. It's a feeling. So this is D.I. Stuart Lewis's side of the story. He says that he was at work in the station doing paperwork until 10 past midnight. Then he went out on patrol in an unmarked police car, a red Peugeot. For the next few hours, he was not in radio contact with anyone, so really no one knew where he was at the time the murders happened. He had never accounted for his movements that night, never explained why he didn't report the murders when he returned to the station. The Thames Valley Police were called in to go over the case with fresh eyes, and they recommended that Stuart be investigated. And so he was suspended for a bit, but again, nothing really happened. Even though a taxi driver rang in and told police that he had seen a red Peugeot on Kelvin Road at 1:20 a.m. that morning, so bang in the middle of the window when the murders must have happened. I mean, it's just too many things to ignore. Too many bits of evidence, too many people. And I just feel like, can we reasonably say all of these witnesses are lying or wrong? That seems not possible to me. Why are the police asking for information and then ignoring it? That's the question.
You know, it seems impossible to ignore everything that's coming in, but they do a pretty good job of it.
How do you like the sound of a bank that's built for you, not the 1%? Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Well, you should check out Chime. Chime isn't just another banking app. They unlock smarter banking for everyday people with products like MyPay, giving you access to up to $500 of your paycheck anytime, and getting paid up 2 days early with direct deposit. They also don't charge an overdraft or minimum balance fee, so you're in control of how you spend your money. In fact, there's no monthly fee at all. Instead of charging you to use your own money, Chime actually turns everyday spending into real rewards and progress. It's the new way to build credit history with your own money and get rewarded every single day. Plus, you can earn up to 3% APY on savings, which is 7 times higher than a traditional bank. Several of my mates have already switched to Chime for their everyday spending, and they say that they have never felt more in control of their money. Chime is not just smarter banking, it's the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. It just takes a few minutes to sign up. Head to chime.com/redhanded. That's chime.com/redhanded.
This time of year, as I'm running from recording to meeting to catching up with my friends, I am so thankful for my wardrobe staples. Those things I can reach for over and over without having to constantly think about what I'm going to wear. Those items that elevate pretty much every outfit. And those that work for me on those days when the weather just won't make up its mind. And honestly, that's why I love Quince. Quince is all about elevated essentials that feel effortless. Everything is designed to mix, layer, and last, so that you're building a timeless wardrobe instead of chasing trends. I'm definitely eyeing up one of their 100% organic cotton sweaters. Everything is built to hold up season after season. The stitching, the fit, the fabrics. These pieces are ones you'll reach for over and over. And the quality honestly speaks for itself. Quince works directly with safe, ethical factories and cuts out the middleman, so you're not paying ridiculous brand markups. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/redhanded for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/redhanded to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/redhanded.
Starting something new can be exciting, but also terrifying. When we started Red Handed, we had no idea if anyone would actually want to listen to two mates who barely knew each other banging on about true crime for an hour. But nearly a decade later, I know in my heart and in my bum that we were totally right to believe in ourselves and launch that podcast from that weird kitchen, despite all of the horrifying fear. It also helps when you have a partner like Shopify on your side. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the US, from household names like Gymshark and Mattel to those just getting started. You want people to learn about your brand? Shopify creates emails and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. It's like you've got a marketing team behind you, even if it's just you and your laptop, or maybe your cat. And if you get stuck, Shopify's always around to share advice with their award-winning 24/7 customer support. It's time to turn those what-ifs into today. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/redhanded. Go to shopify.com/redhanded. That is shopify.com/redhanded.
Over a year passed since the deaths of the Power family and no arrests were made. The police wandered around 1,000 homes and interviewed over 5,000 people.
It feels so much like they're doing busy work. It's like they're just like, let's go talk to all of the thousands of people and we'll ignore the fucking e-fit, the witnesses, the red Peugeot, all of that. We're just going to not look at that. We're going to talk to these 1,000 people. Fuck off.
Eventually, but did take them a year, Alison Lewis was arrested on the suspicion of murder and Stephen was arrested on suspicion of conspiracy to pervert the course of justice. I think Americans call it something different. I don't think they say perverting the course of justice, but I can't remember what it is. Anyway, perverting the course of justice is a nice phrase. So both of them were arrested without charge, even though the mystery fingerprints found at number 9 and in the tool shed and in the bedrooms belonged to Stephen Lewis.
Dun, dun, dun.
He claimed that he had never set foot in that house in his entire life.
I think you're lying.
Yes, I think the forensic evidence would indicate that you are lying. And also the fact that it was in the tool shed, which is where the murder weapon was kept as well. Like, who goes over to someone's house and goes into the tool shed? Nobody.
Nobody.
Unless you're a trowel pervert.
Oh, mate.
9 Kelvin Road was eventually sold for £7,000. It had been bought for £39,000.
I mean, four people were murdered and then fire damage. As my builder would say, that's a big job.
Tips from the public kept rolling in, and in February 2001, an off-duty police officer overheard in the pub that local piece of work, full-time labourer and part-time petty criminal, David, or Di Morris, had also been sleeping with Mandy at the same time as Alison Lewis. And this story was backed up by Di's cousin, Eric Thomas. Imagine having that on your shoulders.
Oh my God.
Obviously, you don't know what happens yet, but I know, and Saruti knows, and soon you will know. But being a family member that was like, yeah, he was shagging her actually.
Oh God.
But this was great for the police because finally they had a suspect who was not an inside man and could have had a jealous lover's motive.
How fucking quickly they move on this. How fucking quickly they move on Di Morris. They're like, get him, boys. Quick.
Someone who's just like off duty in the pub gets a whiff that it might not have been the Lewis brothers. Bring him in. So Di was tracked down on the 20th of March in a flat he lived in with his long-term girlfriend, Mandy Jewell, or Jewell, possibly. This Mandy Jewell, was also arrested on suspicion of perverting the course of justice, but she was very soon released.
That's so smart, isn't it? To just, like, have an affair with somebody with the same name as your partner so you never accidentally say the wrong name and you don't have to humiliatingly call them babe all the time so you don't fuck it up. Smart.
When I was at university, I dated this actor for a while who had quite a complicated Pakistani name. And I just never said it because I knew I couldn't pronounce it. So I just never said his name.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
We went out for months. Didn't say it once.
You know, that is one of my tests. If I date a guy for a while and I've never heard him say my name, I'm like, this is never going to work out. The fear in your eyes when you look like you have to come to say my name. It's never going to work, is it? Say it. Say my fucking name. Anyway, before I start singing a song that I have no business singing, let's move on.
You love Destiny's Child so much.
I can't not listen to it. And I can't not pick it at karaoke. And Hannah will tell me off because she's like, stop picking Destiny's Child. You can't sing Destiny's Child.
No, that's not what I said. I just said they've just got a lot of words in them.
It's very hard songs.
They're very difficult songs.
You're right, though. I shouldn't be picking it because I can't sing it. I can't sing. I definitely can't sing Destiny's Child. But just makes me so happy.
I just love the enthusiasm of it, though.
It's just so great. But Hannah is a legit amazing singer. I don't know if we've ever shared a clip of you singing. What happened to that song you sang when we were in LA? Did we ever video that?
No, I don't think so.
Hannah is a fantastic singer. So next time you guys come to a live show and we do a Q&A, somebody just say, sing, and then she'll have to do it.
No, I will not. No, I think I've hung up the vocal cords, I think. I don't know if I'm going to...
No.
I used to really miss it when I felt like I had no creative outlet at all. But now I do this all the time. I'm like, well, I don't need it. See you later, singing. So those years of practicing every day, no problem, don't worry. It's all for nothing.
Good. Chuck that in the bin.
Well done, me. Goodbye, grade 8. So, absolutely none of the DNA evidence or fingerprint evidence found at number 9 was a match to Di Morris. The only thing that connected him to the scene was the gold chain. Eventually, he admitted that this gold chain was his, but he had a reasonable explanation for how it got there. So this is the chain that's found on the floor of Doris's bedroom. And he had been at the house one day before the fire, before the murders, having sex with Mandy. And he left his chain there because it had broken. He'd meant to pick it up in the day of the fires, but he was a bit too worried that Mandy Jewell would catch him out. She'd caught him out for being unfaithful before, and she'd hit him over the head with a plank of wood for it.
Are these people living in Punch and Judy? What is happening? This is so extreme. But I can also believe that.
Honestly, everyone shagging everyone. It just seems like a complicated web of lies and fluids.
It's far too complicated for my little brain to keep up with, to be honest. I could never keep a story straight like this. But I can believe broken jewelry, leave it behind. I can believe that. Why do I need this? Just chuck it. Makes sense. So Di Morris, the man whose DNA wasn't found anywhere in this house apart from his gold chain, was not the most popular man in Cluedac because he was a thief. A habitual amphetamine user. He was violent, especially against his ex-wife. He drove without a license and was all round a pretty nasty piece of work. Most people in town had a bone to pick with him. But was he a murderer? This is what he told police happened on the night of the murders. He said that he had gone to the pub to watch Wales play South Africa with Mandy Jewell. At the pub, he drank and took drugs. Then he left the pub, got home at around 11:30 p.m. and went to bed. The first he or Mandy Jewell had heard of the murders was on the Sunday morning, like everyone else.
I never understand the use of amphetamines or drugs in general in a pub. Like, I can understand if, like, oh, you're going to go dancing. It just seems a very odd thing to do.
Seems like a waste.
Especially amphetamines. Like, you're not going to want to sit down.
What are you doing at this pub that you're on fucking meth? I don't know. Seems like a lot. But I don't know. I've never taken meth. So maybe it's the most fun you can have at the pub, watching a rugby game.
Maybe meth is chill. Maybe we've just been wrong the whole time.
Maybe meth is chill now. Don't do drugs, guys. Don't do drugs, kids. We're not advocating drugs. Don't yell at us. Right. So this is the story that Di Morris tells. But later on, Mandy Jewell admitted that that wasn't really what happened. She said that she and Di had had an argument in the pub. Maybe all of that meth. Maybe meth isn't that chill. Who knows? And so they had actually left separately. She said that she went home, but that he didn't show up until about 3 a.m. So really, now, with Mandy telling this story, Di had no alibi at all.
Which, like, not great, but, you know, I don't have a partner, even though I live with several people. There are so many times where technically I wouldn't have had an alibi because I've come home late, no one's heard me, and I'm in my room on my own. It'd be impossible for me to prove that I was actually here.
Precisely. So now what you need to do, Hannah, is not only keep all of your receipts, but also when you come home, bang that door really loud and announce yourself.
Oh, I've done that a few times and got big trouble for it.
I know. And then also bang the door, announce yourself really loud, bang your bedroom door and say, no one bother me, and then sneak back out and do some murders.
Oh, the perfect crime.
And put those weird mannequin legs sticking out the bottom of the bed. So if anybody comes and has a little peek, put some pillows in the mannequin legs. And I could just see, like, the investigators standing around just shaking their heads like, it was the perfect crime.
She must have an interest in crime scenes. She must be forensically aware.
There are sock puppet prints everywhere, though.
I so would do a sock puppet murder.
So anyway, sorry, back to the story. So after Mandy told her real story, according to her, Di had to retell his story. And this time he said that he had started to walk to his parents' house. But on the way, he got caught in the rain and realized he was in the wrong place and turned back to reconcile with Mandy Jewell. What? How is that a better story? He walked to his parents' house until 3 a.m. and realized he was in the wrong place and then walked home.
He realized he was in the wrong in the argument with Mandy.
Oh, I see.
So he stormed off. And then he's like having this like soul searching walk in the rain.
Okay.
And then he's like, oh, Mandy, I was wrong.
Oh, Mandy.
I'm so sorry. Take me back.
Also, can we just point out the fact that being in the pub on meth doesn't make a lot of sense. What makes infinitely less sense is going to your parents' house on meth. That's the last place you want to be.
In addition to this, so he has the flat that he lives in with Mandy Jewell. He also has another flat that he rents specifically for when they have arguments and she doesn't want him to be there. But he didn't go there.
I see. Property tycoon.
Maybe I'm just like, wait, if you can buy a house for 50p in South Wales, maybe I'll just move there.
Let's fucking go, man. Let's get out of here.
He doesn't do himself any favours with this bit.
No, not at all. But again, it's like we've talked about on this show before, and generally like is like quite a well-known true crime plotline, is the idea that innocent people, and I'm not saying Di Morris is innocent, I'm just saying let's have reasonable suspicions based on the evidence that is presented and what is ignored by the police and what is jumped on by the police. Innocent people or not guilty people generally tend to make themselves look more guilty because they lie about things and don't have necessarily making sense stories because they don't realize that they need to have an alibi or need to have a cover story. So yeah, I don't know. So obviously when Di Morris told the police this story, like many of you listening and like us, they decided that this was bollocks, but they decided to come up with their own version of events now. They reckoned that Di Morris had left the pub in a rage after his argument with Mandy Jewell. So then he took himself off to Mandy Power's house, demanding sex from her. When she turned him down, he killed her and her whole family, in the process knocking his chain off so it landed on the floor of 8-year-old Doris's bedroom. So this story maybe explains some things, but it does not explain the fuse being changed or why none of his DNA was found in the house. And another viable suspect's DNA was found in the house and in the fucking shed.
After Morris was arrested in his home, he was taken off to Swansea Police Station. And at 1:34 p.m, he spoke to a solicitor called David Hutchinson. This consultation was overheard, apparently, by DI Shane Ahmed, who was rather conveniently testing surveillance equipment in the very next room. And he wrote down the conversation he heard on a post-it. Essentially, what Ahmed is saying he heard is David Morris saying, quote, I've been shagging Mandy for a long time. I shagged her and I arrived home at 4 in the morning. I left my chain there. This snapshot of chat, of course, places Di Morris in 9 Kelvin Road on the night of the murders, which he had up until that point denied. So these post-its were transcribed into a notebook and logged as having taken place at 1:39 p.m. But, according to the solicitor, that was impossible. He claims that not only did Di Morris never say those words, but also that they only started to discuss the case at 2:05. So there is no way that anything close to the post-it note conversation could have happened at the logged time. So, was it fabricated evidence? If it was, it would not be the first time the South Walian police had used a made-up piece of overheard conversation in a murder case. It's exactly what they did to wrongfully convict three men of colour in 1987. They convicted them of the murder of a sex worker called Lynette White, and they're now known as the Cardiff Three. They were imprisoned based on an overheard conversation noted down by a police officer as they were being held in the cells at the station. The conversation never happened. The Cardiff Three are now out of prison, but they did serve 11 years inside. So this overheard conversation, whether it was fabricated or not, was enough to get Di to trial, and it began in 2002. A video taken of Kelvin Road was shown to the jury. One juror fainted and was unable to continue with the trial. The prosecution, led by Patrick Harrington, stuck to the police's story. Morris had got drunk, high, and rejected, so he went on a rampage. Then somehow he managed to clean every single trace of himself from the entire house.
While he was drunk and on meth.
Yeah, he's on meth, and also he just is quite happy to change a light bulb and a fuse and just, like, hang out and wait. D.I. Stuart Lewis did not give evidence at the trial, and his disciplinary file was not submitted as evidence. All that was said was that his behaviour at the scene of the crime was, quote, calm and efficient. I don't think just fucking off is calm and efficient.
Fuck off. Oh, you're always so calm and efficient. You would just leave, just walking away from a crime scene. This is outrageous. I'm furious. This is outrageous. Let's make a documentary about this and free Di Morris. Has that already been done? I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Character witnesses who had an axe to grind with David Morris were called forward. Some claiming that they'd seen him in the pub on the night of the murders wearing a gold chain, indicating that he had not lost it the day before, like he said he had. But who is really paying attention? It's like the most basic gold chain. Like, if you're thinking of a gold chain that a man would wear, that's the one it is. It's like 12 inches. Like, you're not going to notice that. I really don't think anyone is paying attention to whether a man is wearing a gold chain or not.
No. And I also just feel like I probably wear the same gold chain maybe like 70% of the time I go out, right? If you saw me like quite regularly at the pub, how are you remembering if that day I wore it or if you're just remembering me wearing it the day before or the week before? Like, I just don't believe this. Such bullshit. This is such bullshit. I don't believe it. It's like they focus on the really like pointless, weird bits of evidence that they get from people and ignore all of the other stuff that doesn't fit with what they want to happen. That seems much more credible.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it. That is exactly what they're doing.
It's just fucking square peg round hole stuff.
Yeah, it seems like exactly what they're doing is ignoring loads of evidence to fit their narrative.
And possibly just making some up.
That too. So Alison was painted as the perfect mum at trial, with no reason to kill Mandy. Stephen consistently stated that he did not know about the affair between his wife Alison and Mandy, and therefore he stuck to his story that he had no reason to kill Mandy. So the prosecution closed with the statement, quote, "The jury would never know exactly what happened at the murder scene, but if the victims could speak from their grave, their voices would say, Di Morris did it."
My God. How is that allowed in a court?
Jeez.
How is that not struck from the record?
Mate, what is Di Morris's fucking defense doing, allowing that to be said? Because prosecution are going to try say what they can say. Why was this not challenged? How outrageous is that? I mean, obviously, as you can see, Di Morris never stood a chance at trial, not only because the police were not forthcoming with evidence, they were also very reluctant to even share the forensic investigation of Number 9. His solicitor had also previously been working for the Lewis brothers.
You couldn't fucking make it up, could you?
So yeah, exactly. When I'm like, what is his defence doing? His defence fucking counsel, his previous clients had been the fucking police brothers who are massively implicated in this case, in our opinion. Oh my God. And apparently this lawyer had an agreement with the Lewis brothers that he would not go after them for the murder of the Power family.
How does this happen?
So basically what they're saying is that this defence solicitor had an agreement with the police Lewis brothers that he would not start pointing fingers at them as alternative suspects at trial. How was this allowed to happen? This is completely a stitch-up, in my opinion. Just putting that out there.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. So unsurprisingly, obviously, after all of this, the jury came back with a unanimous guilty verdict, and Di Morris was handed a whole-of-life sentence for the most horrific crime in Welsh history. Just 3 days after the sentencing, Di's ex-wife, Wendy, started the campaign to clear his name, saying, "He is not a murderer. I am positive. I have seen him drink and do drugs, but he is not that sort of person." She started a petition and quickly got hundreds of people behind her. What we can't quite settle is how there was none of Di Morris's DNA found at number 9 Kelvin Road, but he was convicted because humans shed 400,000 skin cells a day. How is there that if he was there, there was nothing? How could he have magically wiped them all away? How could he have known about oxygen-producing bleach? Because, like, the other thing is, like, he admits to having been there, like, at some point before because he was, like, having this affair with Mandy, but it's all gone. So it's like somebody did do such a thorough cleanup job, they also cleaned all of his DNA, possibly. But they did find some fingerprints of somebody else who was massively a possibility of being the murderer, but they just ignored that. It's absolutely baffling.
Truly. And, like, the other thing is, Alison and Stephen's alibis are each other. So how is that possible?
It's not, in my opinion.
In 2005, Morris, quite rightly, got new representation in the shape of Michael Mansfield QC. Michael Mansfield is an extremely famous barrister. He represented the Guildford Four, the Birmingham Six, and, possibly most impressive of all, Mohammed Al-Fayed during the Diana inquiry. He is not fucking about. So Michael Mansfield and Di Morris appealed his trial and therefore his conviction in 2005. The main point was that his old solicitor had some sort of deal with the Lewis brothers, so that the trial, therefore, couldn't have been fair. It's a conflict of interest, at the very least. A trainee solicitor swore that Lewis's previous solicitor had taken phone calls and meetings with the Lewis brothers long after he had agreed to represent Di. So there's very obviously some shady dealings going on there. And three judges agreed that the trial had not been fair and that another one had to take place. So the second trial began in May 2006. But even 6 years after the fire and the murders, the EFIT was never presented. Stuart Lewis's lack of alibi was never mentioned. So they overall flopped it. And Di Morris was found guilty yet again and sentenced to life in prison four times over. In 2007, he attempted to appeal again. It didn't work, but his sentence was reduced to 32 years. His supporters on the outside still stand by him. There are Free Di Morris rallies, pins, ribbons, all sorts. The campaign is attempting to raise awareness of the case for those not on social media. They're doing pretty well on social media, though. The David George Morris Facebook group is still active, and last time I looked, it had over 21,000 members, which is more than we have.
That's great.
So alongside the Free Di Morris murals that we spoke about right at the top of the show, there are additional etchings that say, "Wrongfully arrested, enough's enough, 20 years in prison, set up, SWP corrupt force, and ACAB." My sister sent me like a picture of a piece of graffiti that was, "So she's having a smoke and she's taking ACAB." And I was like, that is very funny. Like the Killers lyric. I'll find it. It's a visual joke, but it's very, very funny. So a member of the Cardiff Three, Michael O'Brien, is a regular at campaign team meetings and often speaks publicly about how Di's fate is a vast miscarriage of justice. He's everywhere. If you Google Di Morris and look at anything in this case, the second article will be something about Michael O'Brien. So the big question is, the moment you've all been waiting for, did Di Morris do it? I doubt it. He definitely didn't have a fair crack of the whip. He also didn't help himself. But, you know, sometimes people don't have alibis. That's just the way it goes.
Precisely.
I do not know if I think it was Alison, if I think it was Stephen, or I think it was Stuart, or maybe it was all of them together, or like whatever combination of that is. I just don't know. But there's something not right.
I think, this is just my opinion, right? Before anybody wants to try fucking sue me, this is just my opinion. I think that it was Stephen, the husband. Basically, the reason I think it was because I think Stuart, his brother, is covering out for him. So he's called him. He's told his brother what he's done. He's like, "Fuck, I fucked up. I killed this entire family. You're going to be probably the one that's called in." And he is. And then he walks away from it. Would you do that if it was your cheating sister-in-law? I don't know.
Would you do it if it was your brother? Possibly. And I think that's what happened.
It's logical to assume that Stuart would try and cover for him rather than doing it himself, because he's one step removed from the whole thing.
Yeah. And this is a very personal crime. And I feel like, I don't know, Alison. She is a karate champion, and there's the martial arts expert said it was somebody with that experience who had done it. But I don't know. I lean towards the husband, and I think his brother covered it up. But that's just my opinion. So if evidence was withheld and fabricated by the South Wales police in order to protect their own, whether it was Stuart or whether it was Stephen, it would not have been the first time. Since the 80s, the South Wales police have wrongfully convicted 11 people for murder, including the Cardiff Three that we discussed. By the time the Clutac murders happened, they already had a reputation on their hands. DCS Wyn Phillips said, quote, "I'm determined that in the event of a trial, there must be no appeal against a guilty verdict as a result of what we have done or have not done. If there is, it must only be on legal grounds." So they had a point to prove, that they weren't corrupt and that the people of South Wales had no reason to distrust the police. So the last thing they needed was three police officers wrapped up in a love fucking oblong threatening to kill people. And then a family of four being beaten, savagely beaten to death, and a DI with no alibi. It's not just a case of them doing it to cover it up. It's like they have a reputation that they need to salvage back from the edge because of all the fuckery they've done in the past. So they are fully incentivized to cover this up if they knew it was the police. So did they sweep it under the rug? We don't know. They certainly swept something under some sort of rug. But there has never been an inquest or inquiry. And as far as we know, all three Lewises are still on the force. So as for Di himself, he is still in prison. After his 2007 appeal, he has resigned himself to a life inside. But he is adamant that he will not play the game. He will not admit to something that he did not do, even if it gets him out of prison quicker. Which certainly seems like an odd play for a guilty man. Not unheard of course, but certainly unusual.
I think the wrong man is in prison is what I think.
It's just really sad. Because the thing is, if they did this to, like, obviously cover up for the fact they don't want their reputation trashed again, there is so many fucking holes in this story. And obviously the sentiment of the public seems to be that this was a stitch-up. It's just done even more, because it's pushed that fear and distrust of the police even deeper. And now that they think it's just, like, a complete covert gang doing whatever the fuck that they want, and they'll stitch you up for murder as quick as arrest you. It's scary. And, yeah, poor Di.
Poor Di. Send us your theories. Maybe you can crack this one wide open. I can't.
And, you know, a good place to start is the biography of Di Morris, rugby star. So if anyone wants a copy, slide into Hannah's DMs and maybe she'll send it to you. So yes, if you want to slide into anyone's DMs, though, you are going to have to follow us on social media. We are on all of the social medias, so you can come follow us at Redhanded the Pod. If you have not done so yet, you should get your tickets to the live stream of the London Podcast Festival, because the in-venue tickets are all sold out because there is extensive social distancing going on. So it is like reduced ticket sales. But it is happening on the 25th of this month, which is September. The times are all to be found in the link that we will put in the episode description. So go check it out. Get your tickets. It's like a tenner. It'll be a good laugh. We've got some fun stories. Fun as in there is obviously murder, but you know what I mean. So check that out. And then also, if you would like extra content, because I know that you would, you can come and hang out with us immediately after this show on Under the Duvet. On Under the Duvet? In Under the Duvet? You know what I mean? For all $5 and up patrons. And we are also releasing lots of other fun stuff, like our monthly In the News is out. We've got a really, really fucking interesting bonus Patreon ep that we put out this month for all $10 and up patrons. We're doing a fucking awesome Halloween live stream next month for everybody. It's just going to be really fun. So go check that out. So here are some people that we have to thank for signing up to Patreon. Thank you very much. Kirsten, Carol Hambly, Cindy Lampley, Kyra, Tom McColgan, Mai Tansky, Angus Fernie, Eleanor Waters, Rebecca Lee, Rachel, Laura Parisi, Penelope Friday. Penelope Friday, that's a fucking great name. I love your name.
That is a fantastic name, Penelope Friday.
It is. I love it. Jordan Wallace, Jennifer Martin, Karen Frotheringham, Amy Frost, Maria E. Parker, Lena, Anjali Srivastava. I'm so sorry, that's an Indian name as well. I am embarrassed. It's because I've forgotten how to be Indian, because now I'm Welsh. Natalie Hutchinson, Katerina Ferguson, Vanessa Ibarra, Chloe Nicklin, Laura Jones, Kerry Weed, Shelby Rose, Judea Susan,
Faith, Alex Reglin, Elise Parker, Kaylee Scullion, Liz B, Stephanie Lyons, Ruthie Loffey, Hannah Lindsay, Kelly, Amanda Swigger, Kristen, Angelique Cox, Tom Doyle, Harriet Holsby, Fiona Webster, Kaylee Olson, Janet Shepherd, Jennifer Cottle, Georgie Kempthorne, Josephine Olson. Oh my God, I can't.
Zoe Anderson, Mel. Jessica Swanson, to save you from yourself.
Thank you.
Kate and Dave, Jade Hopkins, Taylor Cooper, Geraldine Strasser, Kate Gentle, another lovely name, Marie Dowd McGing, Fiona O'Shaughnessy, Lauren Stoker, Kylie Maguire. Maguire's in the house. What's going on? Katie Darling. Jesus Christ, guys, you are really ramping up this name game. Jennifer Hall.
Do you know what I was like? This can also double as like a great thing for couples who are about to have a baby and can't choose a name.
Oh, I had never thought of that.
We should sell it. There you go. It's a new thing. Baby naming podcast.
The baby naming segment. Eri Guthrie, Carly, Kia Thomas, Taryn, Erin Jacobs, Madison Milker, Megan Troop, Laura Elliott, Sarah Gabitas, Michelle Benk, Matt Boyle, Lucy O'Connor, Willa _ Y, Annabelle Rovers, Alex, Karen McCauley, Erin O'Mahony, Ellen Street, Azra Aileen, Emma Parks, Jacinta, Nicola Miller, Freya Porter, Cara, Jenny Mothander, Kirsty Lyons, Anna, L. Clifford, Rhoda Frith, Meg Edwards, Ellie Reynolds, Kerrick, Angel Chadwick, Samantha Takax, Beck Connell, Lauren S., Katie Pugh, I'm so fucking hungry, I'm going to eat this mic, Lisa Lipsitz, Shanine, Casey Pike, Jennifer Myers, Tabitha Prescott, Sarah Reedman, and Cara Greenspan. Thank you so much for supporting the show.
Thank you. We love you. We will see you soon. Goodbye.
Bye.